The major economic superpower that is Japan has encountered serious economic difficulties in the past two decades. What underlies the island nation's troubles? What was the impact of the earthquake and typhoon and the consequent meltdown of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility? How precarious is the Japanese and world economies in the wake of Tokyo's Nikkei stock market plunge last week? And how is Japan orienting itself to regional maneuvers such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the U.S.-Asia pivot? Japan-based journalist and broadcaster James Corbett will share with us his perspectives on the background and destiny of the world's third largest economy. On today's show, Japan Post-Fukushima, a conversation with James Corbett. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 30th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Following many authorized reports in the mainstream medias and our own evidences, I can stress that the Syrian state and its population are under a proxy war led by foreign countries and directly financed and backed mainly by Qatar, who has imposed its views on the Arab League. Turkey, a part of the Lebanese opposition, and some of the Jordan authorities offer a safe haven to a diversity of jihadist groups, each with its own agenda, recruited from many countries. Bands of jihadists, armed and financed from foreign countries, invade Syria through Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, porous frontiers, in an effort to destabilize Syria. There are an estimated 50,000 foreign jihadist fighters terrorizing Syria. Those death squads are destroying systematically the Syrian state infrastructures, electricity, oil, gas, and water plants, high-tension pylons, hospitals, schools, public buildings, cultural heritage sites, and even religious sanctuaries. That's from Report on Syria, Nobel Peace Laureate Mairead Maguire. The Syrian state is under a proxy war led by foreign countries, by Mairead Maguire. Dated May 27, 2013. The United States and its allies continue to escalate their military aggression against Syria behind the smokescreen of a proposed international peace conference scheduled for June in Geneva. Some leading representatives of the Syrian regime are being offered a place in a new political constellation that includes Islamist and other bourgeois opposition groups, and which will be dictated and determined by Washington and its allies, and to some extent by Moscow. The alternative to doing so, as has been made abundantly clear, is stepped-up aggression up to and including direct military intervention. Of the two options, a negotiated agreement is by far the least likely. Every day brings fresh indications of preparations for war against not only Syria, but also Lebanon and Iran, threatening a region-wide conflagration that could yet involve Russia and China. That comes from the article, U.S. and Allies Step Up War Preparations Against Syria, Lebanon, Iran, by Chris Marsden, posted May 26th, originally appearing in the World Socialist website. This year's annual Bilderberg Conference is rapidly approaching, where the world's political and business elite meet in private to discuss their agenda, which will determine future policies that govern global affairs. Some aspects of this year's Bilderberg agenda are gradually coming into view and have the potential for directly affecting not only big multinationals like Google, but every business on the planet. The secret gathering has been gradually forced into public view in recent years, and the run-up to Bilderberg 2013 has been one of great anticipation and not without its share of news. Beyond all the fanfare, however, the central question still remains: what items will be on the agenda at this year's ultra-secret Transatlantic Steering Committee? Google is currently engaged in a battle over unpaid taxes in the UK, which has led political commentators to now call for a new system of global taxation. Not surprisingly, this has become the chief topic of discussion at a series of global summits taking place during May and June. And that's from the article, "The Bilderberg, Google, and the G8, New Global Tax Regime Already in the Works," by Patrick Henningsen, posted May 28th, originally appearing in 21st Century Wire. Millions around the world rallied against Monsanto today, marching in person in nearly 300 cities and spreading the message of food freedom across websites, Facebook, and Twitter. In Austin, Texas, at least 1,000 people took part in an upbeat, passionate celebration of food freedom, farm freedom, and labeling or eliminating GMOs from the food supply. Although the day was rainy, which is rare for Austin, people and families showed up in huge numbers to support the message of protecting our food supply from Monsanto and the biotech industry. Protest signs included language like GMO, OMG, WTF, banish Monsatan, will work for GMO-free food, Monsanto is evil seed of corporate greed. It is especially interesting to note that there were no reporters present from the mainstream media. They acted like this huge rally never even took place. That's from the article, "Millions Rally Around the World in March Against Monsanto." The photos from Austin, Texas, by Mike Adams. Posted May 27th, originally appearing in Natural News. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last Thursday, the Japanese Nikkei stock market index slid down 7.3% to 14,483.98, its biggest tumble since the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami, which crippled the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. The slide rocked global markets, with U.S. markets posting their first weekly loss after a month of record highs. This development is a consequence of an aggressive monetary policy put in place by newly elected Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and the Bank of Japan Governor Haruhiko Kuroda. The goal of the policy is to lower interest rates, stimulate inflation, and increase economic activity. Japan currently labors under a massive debt 2.5 times larger than its gross domestic product. On today's program, we'll try to contextualize these realities, as well as explore the Abe government's political maneuvers at home and abroad with James Corbett. James Corbett is the researcher, writer, producer, and host of The Corbett Report, an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He produces GRTV, the video production arm of the Center for Research on Globalization, and is the partner video producer for BoilingFrogsPost.com, the site founded by FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. His video productions have been broadcast on Sky Satellite Television Channel 191 in Europe and the Next News Network in the US, and his videos have garnered over 11 million views on YouTube alone. James has spent nearly a decade in Japan. We will be spending most of our time together discussing some of the developments in that country over the last few years and how they play into the larger regional and global realities in play today. So it's my great pleasure to welcome a colleague of sorts, James Corbett. Thank you for joining us, James.
Well, it's great to be here, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Japan. I always like to kind of, you know, contextualize matters. And could we maybe go back to, say, the post-World War, World War II, and Japan had emerged out of World War II, because it had been very much, of course, defeated. But we saw over the course of the next few decades a rise to the point that by the early 80s, it had become a staggeringly influential economic power. And, of course, following that period, then we saw the Asian flu. So, I don't know, can you possibly briefly just take us through that trajectory, that history, how Japan, what it was about it that got it moving from where it was post-World War II to the situation there, that first recession back in the late 80s?
Well, I suppose, in a word, the thing that really stands out about Japanese society, and I think that it was one of the hallmarks of the post-World War II era, is the Japanese resilience. It's pretty staggering to think about the changes that Japanese society went through in the wake of their defeat after World War II, and just how quickly the population was turned around from its fascistic, imperialistic past into not only a more pacifist type nature that it's really been bred and inculcated into the people now for generations, and that I can attest to in my time living here in Japan, but also the fundamental changes to society, to industry, to the way that the country functions. I think obviously there has been a continuation in certain of the principles of Japanese society, but some of the changes have been quite staggering to think about, including you could even go to certain basic things, such as the fact that before World War II, Japanese writing, when it was written out in horizontally as opposed to vertically, was read right to left. And after World War II, read left to right. I mean, they literally changed the way that they actually read and write in the wake of the American administration of Japan in the post-World War II era. So basically, I mean, fundamental changes were going on in Japanese society, although I think that the overall structure, a top-down hierarchical structure in which people tend to obey the orders of their superiors, that tended to exist and to remain and to persist. And I think it's part of the Japanese work ethic, I suppose, that was one of the key reasons for its rise as an industrial power, and people's devotion to their companies is very much, I would posit, very much a continuation of the old Japanese feudal state. I mean, we have lord and vassal relationships between people and their companies here, which is starting to disintegrate in the 21st century, but still, I think, was very much in play in the mid-20th century. And I think that that explains, at least in part, the rise of Japanese industry in the post-World War II era. And then, of course, in the 1980s, it hit the bubble era, where basically valuation just went through the roof. There was all sorts of asset and real estate bubble that really fed into itself in a sort of self-perpetuating loop here in the mid-1980s, and of course that did have to come to an end at a certain point. And when the bubble did end up popping in the late 1980s, we saw the three-decade-now-long stagnation of the Japanese economy, and that's really what we're attempting to deal with over here at the moment, or so they say. This is what this new era of Abenomics is all about.
Mm-hmm. And I was also wondering, I mean, you mentioned the resilience of the people, in a word. Do you see the fact that we're talking about several islands, that it's an island nation situated where it is, does that play any particular role as far as you can see?
It certainly plays a fundamental role in the psychology, I think, of the Japanese people, which has been an isolated island nation for much of its existence and for much of the previous 1,000 years before it was opened up to the outside world at the point of the gun in the 19th century by the Americans. It was almost completely shut off to the outside world. There were a few ports where international trade happened, but other than that, the population was quite insular. And I think that we still see that to this day. It's one of the most insular nations that one could think of, at least in the developed world, in terms of the way that the population is still very much, I would say, sheltered from outside influence. It still tends to think of itself as a nation completely separate and apart from whatever may be happening in the Asian region and even amongst the rest of the globe. I think people still tend to see Japan as somewhat unique and somewhat inward-looking and sort of self-obsessed in that way. And I think that is one of the holdovers from not only the pre-World War II period, but even before the 21st century, over the last 1,000 years, I think that's something that's really persisted and helped to shape the Japanese psyche. So I think that is another factor which helps to explain some of the things that happen here and why Japan is often so reluctant to sort of join the trends of the rest of the world that it's supposedly a part of, but in fact is kind of hovering over or around in many ways.
Now, Japan, along with China, is one of the biggest creditors in the world, and the United States is the biggest debtor nation in the world. How does that? Do you see that relationship in terms of where the United States sits and where Japan sits as a creditor? How is that playing out in terms of the kinds of policies that Japan has been putting in place to, bring about some kind of turnaround in their economy over the last 20 years?
Well, the Japanese-U.S. relationship has been obviously the core of Japanese society since post-World War II era. And again, that's another, I think, testament to the resilience that I talked about earlier, that America went from the enemy to not only the friend, but almost the adored nation of the Japanese people very quickly, and has basically maintained that status for much of the last several decades. And in terms of economics, obviously in the 1980s, there was the threat of the growing Japan, and obviously people were looking at the bubble and seeing that as a fundamental rise in the economic giant, behemoth, juggernaut of Japan. But that obviously turned out not to be the case in the long run. I would say over the last couple of decades, Japanese-U.S. economic relations has been eclipsed by both Japanese-Chinese economic relations and perhaps more importantly, U.S.-Chinese economic relations. I would say that is the driving factor of American-Asian relations at this point. And I would say Japan is really just seen as something of a proxy for the U.S., both militarily, but also, I would say, economically, in a lot of ways. And we can start to see that influence coming to the fore in the TPP negotiations over here, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that we might talk about in more detail later. But I would say that is the core of the U.S.-Japanese relationship, that Japan is really something like the U.S.'s toehold in this Asia-Pacific region, or at least this part of the region. Economically, I mean, I would say that the relations between them are pretty much almost in a stasis from where they were in the 1980s. In terms of Japanese car manufacturing, obviously still important. Electronics, decreasingly so, as Apple and other companies have really taken over the role that Sony was playing in the 1980s. So I would say that there's, if anything, been a bit of a stagnation and perhaps even a bit of decline in terms of Japanese importance industrially to America and what happens there. And I think that has been certainly a part of why Japan has stagnated over the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you talk about, there were at least two major world events that were pretty significant economically. Of course, the 2008 bubble collapse of the stock market bubble and as well as the Fukushima Daiichi, or the earthquake and tsunami that struck the island, and among its impacts crippled the Fukushima Daiichi plant. Could you talk about how those events played in with the existing economic conditions in Japan?
Certainly. Could you just repeat what was the first?
Oh, yeah. I was talking about the 2008 economic collapse that affected, you know, the global stage.
I see. All right. Well, I would say that the 2008 collapse, of course, I mean, affected Japan as much as any of the other countries in this region. And I think that was reflected. I think one of the effects in Japan is that the banking system here has always been, I think, the Achilles heel of the Japanese economy, and has been one of the great concerns, the great worries over the past couple of decades, that the stagnation that they've been undergoing here for a couple of decades could turn into a collapse if the banks were allowed to basically work out their insolvency issues in many respects. The Japanese banking system is, I think, notoriously uneasy itself, so it is not really able to handle shocks on its own and requires, I think, a lot of government support and intervention. And I think we've seen that that play out in the last couple of decades in a lot of different ways. And I think in the wake of the 2008 shock as well, I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing about the way that the banking sector might be able to deal with that. And I think that's something that, again, we're sort of seeing play out with this Abenomics and some of the concerns that people are having about the way that that can play out, which I hope we'll get into more later. But but the 2011 shock was obviously something that affected, I mean, Japan in every possible way, not just psychologically in terms of the scale of the tragedy that happened there in the northeast of Japan, but also economically, especially since the Fukushima area is the area that was affected by the earthquake, quake, and tsunami was situated was where a lot of industrial capacity was situated, a lot of manufacturing plants, etc. So I think it was clear from the very outset of the Fukushima tragedy and the tsunami more generally, that this was going to be a rather large-scale economic shock that was going to require some major influx of money and capital from the government in terms of reconstruction and in terms of keeping companies afloat. And, of course, that's exactly what we saw. And so in the immediate aftermath of the disaster, we saw a lot of money being repatriated to Japan in order to pay for this reconstruction. And as a result, the yen actually strengthened. And that created a situation that was obviously adverse to a country that's very much dependent on its exports in order to sustain its economy. And because of the strengthening yen, the export market obviously was adversely affected. So I think, again, we can see that this Abenomics that they're attempting to roll out right now is, in one way, we could see that as a reaction to what happened in the immediate aftermath of the reconstruction that was taking place there in 2011.
Hmm. Yeah, they're calling it Abenomics, you say. I wanted to just follow up on another aspect of it. Is it seems to me that a lot of these Japanese headquartered companies, which employ a lot of people abroad, I'm thinking like Toyota, for example, those companies took a hit, which would have spread to the other countries where they're located and employing people. Is that not an element of the concern as well?
It certainly would be. I don't really have the details on that or how many workers were affected or in what way particularly, but I mean, obviously any company that's working overseas that is going to be adversely affected through a situation like that is going to have that disrupt their operations to a certain extent, although to exactly what extent companies like mm-hmm. Toyota were affected by that, I wouldn't be able to say.
Okay, but they are also like major players on the financial markets, so that, you know, if they're taking a hit, then that's going to have consequences, wider consequences. No,
that's absolutely true. But I think when it comes, for example, to Japanese car makers in recent years, we've seen more emphasis on some of the scandals that we've mm-hmm. seen over safety issues, etc. Mitsubishi and others that have really suffered. They suffered economically because of that. I would say probably more so than specifically the earthquake and tsunami.
Okay, so in the current milieu, there was an election recent in December, I believe, in which Shinzo Abe was elected to power. How does this government compared to the previous government in its approach?
In its approach, it's certainly billed as being 180 degrees, and obviously coming from the other side of the political aisle here in Japan, to the extent that it exists, I suppose that there are some fundamental changes in flavor, in mood, and in policy in this administration. But some of the continuation, I think, we can also see. The last administration, at the very least, gave lip service to the idea that, for example, they had a cabinet-level committee that came together to advise the Japanese government on the issue of nuclear power in the future. And it actually, amazingly, came to the conclusion that Japan should work towards a nuclear-free Japan by the mid-part to the late part of the 21st century, which is a pretty staggering thing for a country that is so heavily, has been so heavily reliant on nuclear energy to come to. And obviously was seen as quite a shift in terms of the administration's take on that and Japanese policy generally. But that recommendation, although it was given some lip service, obviously was never really adopted, and there was never any sort of action plan put into place in order to effect it. And one of the things that the Abe government has come in and made clear is that they're going to basically go ahead with restarting the nuclear reactors here and getting nuclear energy back online. So that's one of the shifts that's taken place. I think there's also definitely a sense that this is an administration that's going to be much more open to playing the game of international economics. And again, that's reflected in the fact that Japan has now signed on to the TPP process, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and is looking to basically open up their economy in a way that that goes much beyond anything that that any previous administration has been willing to do. And another sense in which there is a real difference, I would say, in this administration is the militaristic nature of the rising Japanese nationalism is definitely being curried to by this the Abe government. And one of the particularly atrocious examples of this in recent weeks has been a photograph of PR opportunities that the new Prime Minister Abe went through recently, where he was photographed in a jet, one of the Japanese self-defense forces jets, and it was actually a jet that was numbered on the side, 731, and there's a picture of Abe sitting in this jet and waving to the crowd, basically, and the number 731 there, which is particularly galling for people who know about Japanese military history, because there was a unit, 731, which was responsible for some of the most just appalling human experimentation back in World War II. And if people go out and even read the Wikipedia article on Unit 731 and what it was involved in, it's absolutely some of the most atrocious war crimes of World War II. And this is another thing that Japan has never really apologized or tried to make amends for, which is one of the reasons why it is absolutely so reviled by so much of the East Asian neighborhood here. And so to have the Prime Minister photographed in such a situation, it certainly could not be coincidental, I would say, that he was photographed with the 731, and it did cause a bit of international incident as that photograph made the rounds. So that's just one of the examples, I think, of how this administration curries to the absolute far right, to almost fascistic, imperialistic elements that do exist here, and with sort of a throwback to that. And we've seen that reflected more importantly, perhaps, in policy that's coming out of this Abe government, including the idea that's been floating around for years now, but I think Abe is moving more decisively towards, to amending the Japanese constitution, which was written in the wake of World War II and which prohibited Japan from having an outside military defense force that acted as a military. Basically, the self-defense force is supposedly, at any rate, supposed to be completely for self-defense purposes and not engaged in active military combat anywhere around the world. But they're seeking to revise the constitutional article that actually prohibits the Japanese military from functioning as a military. And that is a particularly worrying sign that a nation that has been so thoroughly pacifist for the last half century is becoming militarized and nationalistic.
You You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Maybe we should just switch gears just for a moment and talk a little bit in more detail about the crippling of the Fukushima nuclear reactors, because that must have had a significant impact on the social strata of the country. I mean, I've heard, although it's not, you know, broadly broadcast in the mainstream, but certainly there have been, you know, anti-nuclear demonstrations. I'm reading reports about something like high levels of radioactive material. People who have people who have been evacuated, of course. And, they said last July that 36% of Japanese children who had been screened had abnormal thyroid growths. Maybe you could, you know, relay it as you recall the events as they proceeded.
Well, actually, as the events proceeded, I was in Canada at that time for a couple of weeks. And so I was out of the country and pretty much detached from what was happening here. So it was... it was particularly interesting from my viewpoint. I actually left Japan the day after the tsunami, completely by coincidence. I was already scheduled to go to Canada. And so for the first couple of weeks, I wasn't here for what was happening, but certainly by the time I got back and was talking to my friends here and about what had been going on, there was a lot of concern over the radiation and what that meant, but I was really surprised overall to see how little it affected people's daily life, certainly on the western side of the nation where I am, which is several hundred kilometers from Fukushima. There was basically no change to daily life, and in terms of the Japanese work environment, I was teaching at public schools at that time here in Japan. There was basically no discussion amongst the teachers or in the staff room or anything like that about the situation. So I was pretty surprised to see just basically how little it affected people. But I would say that obviously for a nation that is the only nation to have suffered wartime bombing, nuclear bombing, obviously this is a nation that is particularly sensitive on the issue of nuclear radiation and what that means. And there is, because of that, there always has been a strong anti-nuclear sentiment and anti-nuclear movement here, but that has been completely subsumed for the most part in the Japanese drive towards nuclear energy, which, by the way, in and of itself was partly not put into place, but the mentality, the groundwork for the possibility of Japan becoming a nuclear energy nation was laid back in the 1950s by CIA-connected op-ed writers in some of the Japanese newspapers here who laid that groundwork, and some of that that history is fascinating to look at. But basically, this is a nation that's been, to a large extent, bribed into becoming a nuclear nation, and we've seen that the nuclear industry here basically proceeds by bribing and paying off local governments to basically situate their nuclear plants in their communities. And some of that came out in the last couple of years as some of the projects that have been stalled because of the shutdown of nuclear power here in Japan, as some of the scandals about how their kickbacks and the money that were being paid to local councils, et cetera, have come out. But I would say that that there is a large sentiment here amongst the general population of anti-nuclear ideas, and that has been reflected in a pretty significant anti-nuclear movement that's developed here and has protested and rallied repeatedly over the last couple of years. And we saw definitely a sort of crescendo in that last summer, where there were extremely large crowds that were coming out every single week in Tokyo to protest the nuclear restart that was being proposed at that time, and basically the nuclear policy of Japan generally. We saw that those protests die down in the winter months, but we'll see if they do kick up again here in the summer once again. But there is a strong sentiment amongst a lot of the population, but of course that is completely counter to the general political sentiment here, which is that that nuclear power is beneficial to the nation, i.e. beneficial to the few at the top who get a lot of the kickbacks and support of the nuclear industry. So I think that we're seeing that kind of that bifurcation of the stratification of society here. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of room for the people to have much of an input in this process. It's mostly decided at the top political levels. So we are seeing indications now that as many as eight more nuclear reactors, four more nuclear plants are going to go back online as early as this July, in addition to the two that were restarted late last year.
And are there any other aspects to the Fukushima disaster that recent events, anything that that the world should be paying attention to but isn't?
Well, there's still ongoing concerns about what's happening at Fukushima and what steps are being taken there. Just as one example of that, of course, Unit 4 is still an ongoing concern in terms of its structural integrity. This is the unit that housed the spent fuel pool, which contains over 1,500 spent nuclear fuel rods, which are still a radioactive threat if they were to become exposed. And the problem is that the building in which the spent fuel pool is contained is itself structurally unstable. And in the wake of something, an earthquake of similar magnitude to what we saw in 2011 were to occur, there is definitely the possibility that the building itself could collapse, and thus exposing those spent nuclear fuel rods directly to the atmosphere, which would be an event even larger than Chernobyl, larger than what happened at Fukushima. I mean, it would be a nightmare of disastrous proportions. So that is still an ongoing concern. And although last year TEPCO started the process of testing out how they were going to start removing these nuclear fuel rods, to the best of my knowledge, the actual process of starting to remove these rods and get them transported somewhere else isn't going to really begin in earnest till this December. So there is still some of those types of issues. There's been recent issues regarding some of the radioactive water leaking at the site. There's still the question of containing the radioactive water that continues to be generated there, tens and tens and tens of thousands of liters that need to be stored, and space is running out. So the TEPCO has proposed on a number of occasions basically just dumping it directly into the ocean, et cetera, et cetera. There's still a lot of those types of issues that get very scant attention, even in the media here, let alone the international media. But and of course, scandals continue to emerge about whistleblowers being improperly fired from TEPCO and from the local Fukushima government, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of those stories continue to actually be important, but very few outlets are really concentrating on them, and I would say virtually none in the international media.
Yeah, strange, considering the stakes. I wonder, I opened the conversation with the mention of last week's market collapse, or the stock collapse, the 7.3% hit on the Nikkei index. Now, Abenomics, as you called it, it's a very aggressive policy that's it's geared to, I guess, a kind of quantitative easing. That basically increasing the monetary, or basically having the banks, the Bank of Japan, basically being the main lever by which they're going to stimulate the economy. Could you maybe trace that in terms of how the United States quantitative easing and the also what's happening in Japan and other factors that are coming into play there? You maybe
absolutely well as you correctly point out, it is basically using the Bank of Japan as the lever by which they hope they're going to end this period of stagnation and deflation here in the Japanese economy, which has been particularly stultifying here. Japan has just unbelievable debt levels, something in the range of, I believe, 240% now of debt to GDP, which is completely insupportable, except for the fact that the Japanese population has, by and large, used Japanese government bonds as their preferred form of long-term savings. So the Japanese people have been the largest consumers of Japanese government debt, and that has been a sort of enclosed insular system that supports itself. And unfortunately, that for the Japanese government, that's been unwinding in recent years, and is going to continue to unwind as the aging population here begins to retire and begins to draw on those bonds rather than buying new ones. And that's only going to further add as a drag to the economy here. And the question is, how do they get people away from this mentality of basically buying bonds or just parking money in their bank or stuffing it under their mattress because of the deflationary tendency here for the last couple of decades? Everyone has basically realized that that rather than investment, they could simply just park their money in the bank and it will continue to retain its value or perhaps even go up in value. And that has been problematic for the economy. How do you generate domestic demand in such a situation? So the answer, of course, is inflation. If they can start to inflate the yen, then basically people will be encouraged to put that into the stock market, at the very least buying more government bonds as a way of shoring up their value of their money. And so that's basically the idea, or at least supposedly the idea behind this shift, this Abenomics, as it's being termed. And the idea is to double the Japanese money supply in the next couple of years. And they're already starting to do that. They're starting to stimulate the monetary base here. And we've seen basically everything sort of kicking online in the way that I suppose that they would have wanted it to happen. Including the stock market rally here, which has seen, I believe, upwards of 70% gain in value over the past 6 months, just a staggering rise, which has been offset in the last week or so, as you note, by a precipitous fall. And that's a particularly worrying sign that the wheels are already coming off of this Abenomics experiment. But to a large extent, in terms of the psychological factors that are at play here, it has been successful in at least convincing some of the Japanese population and the international investment community that there is a change taking place here, and that the economic rules are changing. And we saw that reflected in the fact that the first quarter GDP growth here in Japan was 0.9%, which is 3.5% annualized. Quite an incredible, stunning display for such a moribund economy. But unfortunately, when you look at the underlying data behind that, most of that was down to consumer sentiment. Basically, people are more interested in investing and more interested in spending in the economy because they believe that this Abenomics is going to basically reignite the Japanese economy. But when you look at capital spending, it actually dropped 0.7% during that same quarter. So again, some of the fundamentals underlying the economy are absolutely nowhere near what they should be to reflect the value that supposedly has been generated in this remarkable stock run-up. And so I think what we're seeing right now is the markets are starting to reassess whether they've faked a little too much into the equity cake when it comes to the Nikkei and the startling run-up in prices here in stocks. And another thing that is particularly worrying is the volatility in the Japanese government bond market that we've seen in recent months because of these policies and what the Bank of Japan is doing, to the point where they've had to suspend trading in government bond futures several times now over the past few weeks because of precipitous drops in the valuation of the Japanese government bonds that have taken place. So we have seen some incredible volatility happening in the bond markets, which is, I think, the nightmare scenario for this whole Abenomics and might expose what's really going on here. Basically, the volatility shows that they don't have control over the bonds and they will not have control over the inflation that's going on here, so that their 2% target is anyone's guess as to whether they'll be able to attain anything like that. And meanwhile, the economy is likely to start falling apart if there is some sort of fundamental change in the underlying fundamentals of the economics that are going on here. Broadly speaking, how this fits into the larger global picture, I think we can see this Abenomics quantitative easing round as just a further reflection of what's been going on internationally, of course, starting with the Federal Reserve and their quantitative easings 1, 2, 3, and 4. aka Dewey Infinity, because there is no set end date to what Bernanke and crew have started there. But also what we've seen with Draghi's so-called bazooka at the European Central Bank and the threats of more quantitative easing there, what we've seen in recent months developing is the start of a currency war, a race to debase the currency in order to make exports the most attractive they can be on the international markets.
Yes.
And the G7 has come out, the G8 has come out with a statement saying that they won't be participating in a currency war, and that quantitative easing is based solely at domestic concerns, not international concerns, et cetera, et cetera. They can say that till they're blue in the face, but the reality is that that's exactly what's happening, and country after country is trying to devalue their currency in order to compete with the others on the international markets. And I think that's the way that the Japanese quantitative easing has to be seen, especially for such an export-heavy economy. This is absolutely an attempt to gain whatever type of advantage they can when it comes to the international markets, and so we're really more likely to see more and more of this happening. And exactly as you indicate, now that Bernanke has at least floated the idea that possibly they might have to start at some point in the near future easing off on the gas pedal when it comes to their easing, and the markets have been spooked by this because it's been so baked into the economic cake now that just the idea that they will actually stop or even slow down with some of their easing is enough to make investors once again quite skittish. So unfortunately, what we've got is this type of system where the only thing that can feed this sort of heroin habit of the investment community is to continue injecting, not just continue injecting heroin of quantitative easing, of easy credit and money, but to keep injecting it at faster and faster rates. And if that isn't done, basically, the threat is that the so-called recovery of the last few years is going to completely fall apart. So this is part of a broader global phenomenon that's taking place right now. And I really do believe that Japan is in many ways the canary in the coal mine, economically speaking, and that if and when the wheels start to fall off of Abenomics, I think it will have some not only direct knock-on effects in the global markets, but I think we'll also have indirect effects, because this is likely what we'll start to see play out in Europe and America eventually, just given the similarities in a lot of the situation there.
You're listening to a conversation with James Corbett, Osaka, Japan-based journalist and broadcaster, about the current economic and political situation in Japan. In the discussion that follows, I asked Mr. Corbett to place Japan in a larger regional and global context.
You mentioned the TPP earlier, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On a previous episode of the Global Research NewsHour, we had a guest talk about his idea that basically the TPP is an aspect of the what's called the Asian pivot, where the United States is essentially seeking to dominate the region, or at least protect their influence in the region, and they see China as their main rival. Now, Japan has a trading, a bilateral trade agreement with China. And there's, of course, as I believe you yourself have commented on previously, that there's a standoff with China over a number of islands. I'm wondering how China fits into this overall picture, where you have the two major powers at odds with each other, and Japan is sort of caught in the middle. How do you see Japan's, where it's positioned, and its involvement with this, or its recent interest in participating in the TPP? I believe they are scheduled to become official partners in July. How is that aspect of it playing out?
Well, it is an interesting sort of balance, or not so much balance from the outside perspective, but I think that underlying what's really happening is, as you say, they're sort of caught between the rock and the hard place of the being a U.S. proxy, more or less, in the region, and also having a growing economic dependence on trade with China. And I think we see this reflected in some of the rhetoric and things that have emerged in the last several months. For example, in the last couple of months of 2012, we saw a lot of talk between the two sides about the disputed islands in the East China Sea, talking about ownership and Japan taking that step of nationalizing the islands, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, just some really ridiculous and bellicose rhetoric that continues to this day. There's still the threats of Chinese submarines entering, did they enter Japanese waters, et cetera, and if they do, Japan threatens military action. I think that a lot of that that warlike rhetoric, however, has been political in nature more so than it is an actual reality that's going to develop militarily. I think Abe, obviously, in the time when he was running for office, was interested in having this played up, because anytime a potential political leader can sort of grandstand on threats to nationalism, etc., I think that basically political leaders always love to take advantage of that. So I think we have to see those types of developments in that context. But underlying that, I think, is the reality, as you pointed out. There are bilateral trade relations between Japan and China. There is a growing slice of the Japanese economy which is dependent on that trade with China. So I think that ultimately they're not going to really try to rock that boat too fundamentally. I think they have to play up the rhetoric for both the home population, and also because obviously they are part of the U.S. military umbrella, and I think that they need to placate their U.S. masters, I suppose, for lack of a better word, in those terms. But again, I think that the risk of upsetting trade with China is too much to actually spill over into any sort of real military confrontation. And I think that that's something that's really underlying this whole Asia-Pacific pivot that the U.S. is undergoing right now, where they're trying to exert more influence through some of their proxies in the region and some of the other trade groupings, etc. ASEAN is perhaps potentially going to play a greater role in the region, or being built up as some sort of bloc that might be able to be some sort of geopolitical counter to China's influence. But I think that's very much up in the air at this point. And the TPP has to be seen in those relations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a type of free trade bloc that's being formed here, which Japan is just one of, I believe, 10 signatories at the current time, that encompasses many of the nations here in the Asia-Pacific, and also, of course, Canada, America. And what this TPP is, I think, really about, I mean, obviously this is just an extension of globalist the globalist mindset that's been, and the free trade agreements that we've seen in the past. For example, in the North American context, obviously NAFTA, but I think that this is just another extension of that in the formation of this worldwide trade bloc that I think international capital is really trying to hammer out at this point. And the way that this affects Japan specifically, Japan has really extremely protective tariffs when it comes to, for example, their local agricultural production. Japanese rice, for example, famously protected by 800% tariffs, etc. So breaking down some of those tariffs in the name of free trade is going to have a fundamental effect on the Japanese economy. And as a result, I mean, a lot of farmers are pretty much universally against the TPP here, and some of the other industries that might be affected by this. But of course, big business and big politics love these types of agreements, because it always leads to the enriching of the very, very few at the very top. And that's exactly what we're seeing here, and this is why Abe is pushing for this so hard, and why it's likely to go through in some form or other here. It's just a question of whether Japan will be able to get any of the concessions that they're seeking, for example, exemptions to their agricultural tariffs, etc. But that seems unlikely, and I think what we're going to see is basically the formation of this free trade bloc that's going to fundamentally transform the Japanese economy, let alone the economy of the other signatories.
I guess I have one more question I'd like to put to you before we close, and that's with regard to the some of the drama around North Korea. We've seen the United States and South Korea involved in military drills that were seen as quite provocative by North Korea. And I'm wondering if you connect that drama in any way with maybe an attempt to catalyze Japan's actions. You know, you mentioned that Japan was under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And so with North Korea being a nuclear power, I'm wondering if that may have, in some sense, worked to maintaining, may have been at least on one level an attempt to remind Japan of, you know, who they should be aligning themselves with. Do you read anything?
Well, it certainly does play out that way. Anytime that North Korea starts rattling the saber, I think it becomes extremely apparent that, of course, Japan is very much embedded with the U.S. military. The U.S. military is very much embedded in Japan. And I think that comes to the fore every time that those types of incidents occur. And it reminds the population of Japan, at any rate, that that they are under the protection of the U.S. and that they rely on U.S. military deployments for their ability to counteract that threat. So it plays out that way. And again, regardless of the extent to which all of this is theatrics, I think that these types of theatrics do play into the hands of pretty much every player in the region. North Korea, obviously, always attempting to bring people back to the table, or at the very least, to just win some more outright concessions and aid to continue to prop up their failing regime. But obviously, Japan gets to convince their population that the things like the deeply unpopular U.S. military deployment in Okinawa is necessary and a vital part of the safety and protection of Japan. It also, of course, plays into the U.S. hands, especially now that they're attempting to institute this this Asia-Pacific pivot and trying to basically deploy more of their assets in this theater. And I would say every major power has something to gain from this, even China, which obviously fears the collapse of North Korea because that would send a lot of refugees in across the border and would be a difficult situation for them. But I think that they, to a certain extent, they get to win on this type of saber rattling as well, because they get to be seen as the rational people who are basically keeping North Korea in check. So everybody has a stake in this type of thing. And I think one of those ideas that we see play out is that every time North Korea starts to rattle the saber and make these types of bellicose moves, well, what we see is basically the Japanese population gets to be reminded of why they need American military protection. So it certainly works out for the powers that shouldn't be in that regard.
Well, James Corbett, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on the goings-on in Japan, and look forward to more of your interviews and productions on your own website. So thank you very much for being my guest on this edition of the Global Research News Hour.
Well, thank you again for having me on. I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm here anytime you need me.
Okay. Thanks so much, James. And that was James Corbett, a researcher, writer, and producer, and host of The Corbett Report. You can find his interviews and videos at corbettreport.com. And, of course, you can also visit his productions at the Center for Research on Globalization, GRTV, and that's at globalresearch.ca.
That was journalist and broadcaster James Corbett, producer and host of The Corbett Report, speaking on the subject of Japan's current economic and political challenges. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.